I was looking at the weather in Montana. I think it said -5 in Whitefish. So that was going to be one of my questions. Like, huh, you like a big trainer fan or a big winter sports fan?
Really, I would say probably neither, because I left to go to California. I mean, I think since moving to Montana, I have embraced winter sports as much as I think I can. Luckily, where we are in Whitefish in the northwest corner of the state, there is a pretty amazing infrastructure for winter sports. I mean, I think that's largely a function of the fact that if there wasn't, I think people would go insane. But luckily, we live right next to a golf course that grooms for Nordic, and that's like a flat circuit around, little rolling hillsides of the golf course, which is lovely. And if you want something more challenging, the mountain near where we live, and I always joke about this, the name of the mountain is just called Big Mountain. I mean, they really just mailed it in on that one. Like, they weren't too creative with it. Big Mountain has specifically sectioned off areas of their recreation land that is meant for skiing, like cross-country skiing. So they groom the tracks there, and those are much more challenging, hillier, a little more technical courses that you can use. I rarely go up there because most of the time I'm just, crashing out or just yard sailing because I'm just not good at Nordic skiing at all. And then, in addition to that, the biggest thing that I would say I do in the winter when I'm still in Montana is a lot of I don't know. I don't want to say necessarily skimo because I feel like that's embellishing the actual skill level with which I am skiing. I generally just say skinning, but as I've come to learn, like, not a lot of people actually know what that is. So I just say skimo, but I don't want to say that because there may be skimo listeners to the podcast, and I
I don't know what chemo is. That like ski? I'm hearing ski and mountain, but that might not be what it is.
No, that's exactly what it is. It is skimo is an abbreviation for ski mountaineering. So effectively, as I've come to learn it or learn about the sport, it's kind of like I don't know. I'm trying to think of it in terms of analogies to road cycling, where I would say like Nordic skiing is the super nerdy, like, track cycling. You get dialed in with your skin suits and all the super aero tech or whatever, and it's a very, like, groomed, curated course. Skimo, I would say, is the road cycling of skiing, where there's a little more freeform function of it, but it's still fairly, like, tech heavy, nerd kind of territory, because it's a lot of like lightweight equipment. It's a lot of like very technical talk in terms of the equipment. And then you have downhill, which is just like the mountain biking equivalent of skiing, I would say. And that is my I'm not a skier analysis of skiing, and I'm sure people have their opinions on that. But skimo is effectively like the middle ground, I would say, between Nordic and regular alpine skiing, where you can strap skins, or a lot of the skins have this adhesive texture to the back of them. And I guess to back up, a skin, that term effectively means like a strip of unidirectional fibers that you can stick to the bottom of your ski, and effectively they allow you to walk up a hill on snow because the fibers grip the snow. So you can walk up the
Whoa.
mountain, peel the skin off the ski, pack it in your backpack, and then ski down. And so there's a huge culture of that in Whitefish, where we have a very fortunate capability to skin all day, effectively, because a lot of resorts, they limit the access that you have to skinning the mountain to certain hours of the day, so that you're not necessarily getting in the way of uphill, or excuse me, of downhill traffic. But luckily, our resort allows all day skinning, so you can pretty much just, between the hours that the lifts are open, and even after the lifts are closed, I mean, basically, you can go up and down the mountain all you want if you're willing to hike it. And it's an insane workout. I mean, that
I
was
was
the
like, that
thing that I
sounds
discovered.
brutal, man. That sounds
Yeah,
super
no,
hardcore.
it's really hard. And I think that was what was really cool about it is, you know, as I was trying to wrap my brain around living in a place with not only just winter again, but legitimate winter, having lived in California for 7 years since I moved here from the East Coast, it was nerve-wracking because I'm like, oh my God, how am I going to train? What am I going to do? But when the snow is good and you can actually skin on the mountain, that is a serious workout because the route that we take typically is a 2 mile hike basically from the base of the mountain where the resort is located to the peak of the mountain. It's a 2 mile straight uphill that in some cases I think it's legit like a 45-degree angle or something like that,
Whoa.
something crazy stupid. So from the base to the top, if you're chugging along at like what I would call, you know, a zone two pace or something like that, it's like a 45-minute lap. And then it
Okay.
takes you maybe, you know, 10 to 15 minutes to ski down. Takes me a little bit longer because I'm not very good. But you can get a serious workout in if you want. And what I found out is it was just like a great way to be able to get outside that allowed you to get like a very consistent workout in that is fairly analogous to the kind of muscle recruitment or endurance effort you would put in on a zone two bike ride. Nordic skiing is a whole other story because it's one of those things where unless you have been doing it for your entire life, I think it is almost impossible to master the technique. For example, it's someone my age who's just trying to like do it. And so I look like an idiot when I'm out on the track. I'm flailing around, but as I've come to learn, or as many people have told me, like I'm just getting a better workout because I'm just making it impossible for
You're
myself.
super inefficient. Yeah, you have
Exactly.
like the
Horribly
knobby tires
inefficient.
on the road, you got your Nash bar vest catching more wind. Like, yeah, I did Nordic in upstate New York a little bit, and my friends were like, it's technique, you're fighting the water, and that's why it's
Yeah,
so
exactly.
difficult. I'm like, well, my heart rate is pegged and I'm not moving very fast, so I'm definitely doing something wrong. But
Yeah,
it was quite the
exactly.
experience. Matt, so you're in California just for the week to avoid the weather, or are you having second
No,
thoughts
I've
about
been
Montana?
It's funny you say that because Jess is she was actually the reason we moved to Montana. She was born and raised there, and you know we're here in California staying with my aunt. And Jess was like, "Man, I don't know if I want to do winters in Montana anymore." And part of me is just like, "Oh no, like we committed to this." But I've been very fortunate. My aunt, she lives in a town called Solana Beach, which is in North County, San Diego. And Jess and I, we used to live in Encinitas, which is two towns up from here. So I've been very familiar with this area, and it's one of my favorite places in the country to train, just because I've kind of figured out how to do the riding here, what are the good roads. So I've been here on and off since I would say late October. So I got here late October, early November, spent a couple weeks here during what we call the shoulder season in Montana. We have a lot of fun names. It's kind of like in California, similar here, they have a fun word for fog. They call it the marine layer in case you forgot that they are next to an ocean. They just like saying that.
I like this.
Whereas same in Montana, we don't call it fall or spring, we call it the shoulder season or mud season. So during that
Okay.
period, it's not cold enough to have any snow or ski, but it's still cold enough to be miserable and rainy. So it's not actually like great training. So we came down here during that period, and I got in a block here before going back up for Thanksgiving, and then I've been here in Solana Beach for a little over a month. I think it's been about 6 weeks because I came here back in early December, and I've just been kind of like trying to put in as much work as I possibly can before the start of the season.
What, and so are you going to stay there then until the season starts? What are you kicking off with, and what's the first race? Are you going straight to the races, or are you going, what's next?
Yeah, so that's part of the reason why there was such like I there was such an earnest desire on my part to try and get down to a place that had like, you know, rideable, outsideable temperatures because
Roads.
roads exactly that weren't covered in sleet and snow. This year will be the earliest I've started my year racing, I think ever, in terms of just like the actual like hard date when I'm going to start racing again, because in years prior when I was living in California, we'd kick things off at like local races such as Santa Barbara County Road Race, formerly or otherwise known as like Four College Kids or Mothballs. And that would be at the very end of January, whereas this year we're starting at Challenge Mallorca, and I'll do 3 out of the 5 days there. And I think the first race is January 24th. So when I joined Project Echelon and I was given the calendar, I'm like, oh my God, like we're starting racing in like 2 months. And
Early.
so, yeah. So that'll be the start of season. So literally I fly out this coming Saturday to head to Mallorca, and then I'll start the racing season next week.
Sick, dude. That's awesome. That's exciting. That's almost, was that UCLA? Did you guys start that early? Collegiate's super early, but is it in January or?
Well, typically when I was at school at UCLA, we would start, there'd be a crew of people who maybe would want to go do some local racing. I think the collegiate season itself generally started in February with the UCLA road race, which if you are, to any listener who might be in California looking for a great road race, I have to plug that because it is probably one of the hardest road races in Southern California. It's one of the few road races in Southern California that still exists. And I will say, if you do go out and support that as a former UCLA alum, like those days, that race day is what helps fund the team. So if you want to support a really great program, one that I think, helps develop a lot of great cyclists in the last couple of years, they've even produced national champions, you should do that race.
Get registered,
But yeah,
people, and actually buzzkill for people. This won't be out in time for them to hear this before that race goes on. But
dang
2025, if you're not there and you heard this podcast, we're coming for you.
it. 2025.
So,
I plugged it too
hold on. We
soon.
got we dove in like real quick. We got to do a quick intro, which I don't like to
Yeah,
introduce
let's do the intro.
people, because people for like the three people that don't know who you are. Who is Sam Boardman? And I can list off all the things that I get from you, but I would love to hear from you. Who are you?
I guess I like the I don't like deferring to social media as a way to define myself, but I feel like I've been able to like kind of condense my biography into the however many characters the biographies in your social media profiles. So I guess I am first and foremost, I call myself a push bikes pilot. You could also consider me an occupational cyclist. For Project Echelon Racing in 2024. I am a Spanglish scholar of a UCLA alum, so I have a degree in English and Spanish. And I am also an event promoter for a gravel cycling event in my hometown of Whitefish, Montana. That is organized by my wife. She uses the event as a fundraising vehicle for a scholarship program that she coordinates with the local school districts and counselors and educators to raise money for qualified young women looking for post-secondary education financial assistance. And on top of all that, I am an aspiring educator. I finished my master's degree in elementary education last year, and so when cycling is all said and done, I'm looking to go back and into the classroom and teach. Hopefully
Sick.
anywhere between kindergarten to, I don't know, fourth grade, I think would be my age range.
Cool.
I love teaching kids that age. And then on top of that, I have to always say, like, I take great pride in where I grew up, in Washington, D.C. That was a place that was obviously formative in, who I am and what I am into and everything about my upbringing. And I always have to say, as someone who didn't ride or race bikes as a kid when I was living in DC, having discovered cycling after I left and then returning to the city anytime I went to go visit my parents, I will always tell people the Mid-Atlantic, especially the DC area, which if you're not from there, people call it the DMV, the DC, Maryland, Virginia area. It is probably one of the most underrated cycling scenes in the country. Truly, like it not only produces a vast amount of national talent, but there are so many cyclists there. The group ride scene is incredibly vibrant and incredibly involved, and the community there is extremely strong. So for anybody who, for example, is moving to that area or is interested in visiting a place with a really strong cycling scene, do not ever underestimate that area. Like DC, Maryland, Virginia has a very good cycling scene.
The Hagerstown Road Race was pretty brutal. Had that one like
Yeah.
kicker climb, if I remember correctly. And
Yep.
I drove through there last year. I was going up to Delaware, I want to say, and I wasn't in Hagerstown, but I was in some. I was on the border. Oh man! But the riding was amazing. I was out in farmland in no time, and just like made up this little loop. And I would have stayed there for a week. I had the best little Airbnb. Damn, like I have 24 hours here. I want to like hang. It was north of Hagerstown, maybe. Anywho, yeah, I'll vouch for that. That I would love to explore
Yeah.
that area a little bit more. I'm in
Is
North
it?
Carolina a lot, so we're getting into the Virginia more. And my buddy
Yep.
Landry's all about new roads and the gravel, and so we've got some more little road trips we need to explore up that way. But I've only heard incredible things from like what you're saying.
I mean, I truly think it's a great place to train. It's beautiful, and especially if you're a history buff, I mean, there's a lot of like really cool historical sites in and around that area that you can go visit on a ride.
That's awesome. We'll plug the ride later too as well, so people don't forget, but it's called the Last Best Ride in Montana. That you do have
Yes.
time to register for August 4th through 6th. We'll put links in the show notes. That's gravel, correct?
Correct. Very much so,
Okay.
gravel. You do not want to do that on a road bike.
Don't bring the road bike. Okay. We'll get more. We'll put some notes there. You guys check that out for sure. And we'll put Jess's Instagram too, because I figure there's probably some like cross content going on
No,
there.
absolutely.
And
I,
so.
as I always tell people, like she is the mastermind behind that. I just, when stuff needs to be lifted and put somewhere else, that's my job. So
You're
like
the
she's the
model.
one
You're
who's,
like, look at this hair. Let me come to
I
the
flip the
ride
hair.
and check this.
I get
Yeah.
the occasional haircut, but she's the one orchestrating the whole thing. So it's all her.
And in your bio, it doesn't say dreamer.
Nah, dude, I'm living. I'm living it.
Doesn't wait, did I am I making that up? I could have sworn
Does it say
Instagram.
Dreamer? Did
Dude,
I
I
put
think
that in?
so.
No, I don't think so.
I feel like it did. Hang on. I'm gonna check this real quick. Damn, you're right. I thought I can't look. I'm gonna look on my phone because I could have sworn where people put like occupation. I thought you had something funny there. Maybe I'm thinking of somebody else. Well,
I
anyways,
think in
never
my,
mind.
like, you can categorize your Instagram
Yes.
channel or your page. Mine is just for fun or something like that.
Okay. Okay. All right. Never mind. You're not a dreamer. So you're just in IRL right now, here and now.
I'm IRL in the moment, living it up.
I love it. So I'd love to chat about a couple things that I was just reading about from you online from the past that I thought was really interesting. And then let's talk about the new squad, and some people are dying to hear about your training. And then we'll have some like miscellaneous things we have time. Does that sound good to you?
That sounds great.
Cool. I was when you were at UCLA, I always love when people kind of catch the bug of cycling, or and I can't remember if I was watching a video or reading an interview that you had done, and you said you weren't really a big athlete when you were growing up, but you wanted to be competitive, and you joined UCLA team, and you quote unquote became obsessed. And what was that obsession like? What do you remember from the early days of when all of a sudden you just thought, oh damn, I love this sport? What was going on?
Well, I think the big thing was I was never competitive as a kid, in any sports, basically between when, I was a young kid to say eighth grade. And between that time, I actually specifically remember telling my friends, organized sports are stupid. And I don't really know what was fueling that. I think it was just this like teenager contrarian in me that didn't want to like organized sports because of course everyone else liked them. And now it's just like I will sit down and watch like whatever sport is on TV because I just love sports now. I was always attracted to bikes though. I loved tooling around on a BMX bike, and so I think that planted the first initial seed of what ended up putting me on the path that I am now, because there was something not only about just the actual freedom and excitement, going around and exploring the city in DC on a bike offered me, but it was also like the actual tactile satisfaction of working on my bike, building the tool that I was, having fun with. There was something that I really liked about that too, and that's something that I still love about cycling today is the tech side of it, and I don't ever want to discount
Oh.
people who just like the tech side, and they don't want to be competitive. They just like building bikes, because that's like 50% of the reason why I like being in this sport, is it's just like there's something so satisfying to that. But to your point, I ran in high school, and I became very obsessed with running in a similar way that I became obsessed with cycling. But I discovered come senior year of high school, when I had figured out where I was going to be going to college, that running at the D1 level, which I think is what a lot of people aspire to, it wasn't really feasible. So between the summer of my senior year, or when I graduated from high school my senior year, and my freshman year of college, I had, because of the way that the semester system in high school and the quarter system of college lined up, I had like 5 months off of school, which was effectively like a gap semester. So I had a lot of time to just like be doing like nothing but working as a janitor at my high school, and then commuting on a fixed gear bike to and from work that my parents had got me as a graduation gift, which I ended up using to go to a bunch of bike parties in DC. And that's what got me hooked on like riding a bike long distance and the cycling community, or what the cycling community could be. I had no idea what road cycling was at that point. I was still kind of fixated on fixed gear riding. And I guess this was 2014, so this was kind of in like the heyday of Red Hook, when that was still, pretty popular. So I was like, oh, maybe I could do a Red Hook crit. But then I decided like I wanted to be able to ride further and more comfortably, because DC is fairly flat, but once you hit a hill on a fixed gear bike, it's just not that fun. You want to be able to shift the gears, you want to be able to like comfortably roll up. I got a road bike in August, and I joined the team largely because there's this void that I had in my life, deciding that I didn't want to run anymore, and I was like, I got to find a way to fill my time, because otherwise I don't see myself being productive in any way. And I knew that I wasn't going to have a car at UCLA, and all I had been told, having spent virtually no time in LA, was that if you don't have a car, you're effectively trapped wherever you are. And so to me, the bike was a way to get off campus, it was a way to explore. And that's, to answer your question, that is what got me obsessed. Like the ability to explore areas of, for example, the Santa Monica Mountains was just pivotal. It was absolutely integral into, the reason why I got into bikes. And I genuinely think like I probably would have found a similar level of obsession had I been anywhere else in the country when I discovered the sport. But I actually think part of the big reason why I think I became so obsessed was, as far as like training goes, I consider Santa Monica Mountains to be like Mecca in America. I truly think it's some of the best training in the world, some of the most iconic climbs, like pros for as long as you can think of have been coming to LA to train there, because it's just so good. And at the time, in I would say like 2014, I would still say, this was like just when, I'm not going to say just when, but like Instagram still wasn't like the super in vogue social media marketing tool that it is right now. But there was this channel that was coming up called LA Sucks for Cycling, and it was kind of just like a cycling group, and it was basically, they were trying to say like, don't come here because it does suck. But it was all tongue in cheek, because I think anyone who lived there understood, if you knew where to go, LA is truly one of the best places that you can train in America. So I would go on these rides, and I would wake up early in the morning. I'd go with a couple roommates or friends or my coach when he was still living there at the time, and he would show me around. The locals would show me around, and it's just the views that you get riding, for example, up one of my favorite climbs in the area is you can go up Las Flores, up to Saddle Peak, or you can go up to, through Topanga, through Fernwood, up to Saddle Peak. And just having that ability to look to one side and you see the ocean glistening in the sunlight. And of course, this was, January, where back home it was, 30 degrees or something. And here I am on the top of a mountain in shorts and like a short sleeve shirt. And then to the other side, you see the entirety of the Inland Valley. And it was just like, there was a moment, and I can't pinpoint when exactly, but there was just like, wow, I did this all by myself. I pushed my own body up a hill, and it was so rewarding. And then it just went from there. Like, the competitive side came, I think, in the racing, but the actual attraction to the sport was born out of that exploration.
That's awesome. I love that. That you had some other good points too in this article, just talking about kind of that exploratory side. And it had me thinking of, I sometimes ask myself, am I a bike racer or am I a cyclist? And I always think that's an interesting conversation that athletes have and how it develops over time. And I think a lot of people, you know, we burn out a little bit, then we come back. And it's just, it's such a cool sport in so many ways to explore it. When you actually just said, hey, I push my own body up this mountain, you had mentioned that you struggle with body image. And can you share on that? Because I think for listeners, especially those just starting, would be like, wait a minute, Sam Boardman? Like, everyone knows he's just this beast, but to hear you feel insecure about something, can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it started in high school, again, with running. And I, you know, it's hard to say because it was never like I sought counseling. And I wish I did. And I think that's the first piece of advice I would have anyone who thinks that they are struggling with this kind of stuff is seek help, because in a lot of cases, like, I know from my own personal experience, I am my own worst enemy. Like, it's so hard to get out of your own head, and you need a voice outside of your own head to be able to tell you, like, you're okay or you have support. So if you're ever needing to seek help, like, find some kind of counseling through, you know, there are tons of online platforms that you can use, or through your partners, or seek out help. In high school, I loved running, but unfortunately with running especially, I think it's a sport more so than others where physiologically, like, there is a body type that you see, like, on, like, every, you know, winning every race, and it's just, it is typically very skinny, very slender, like, people. And it's hard to look at that and be, you know, an aspiring distance runner like I was, or at least wanting to be better at distance running, and not thinking like, oh, I just fell into the same trap that I think a lot of people did. And I would like to reiterate, like, because anybody who has fallen into that trap, like, you're not stupid because you've fallen into that. It's just what happens. And, like, I thought, if I lose weight, I'll be faster. And so I developed this really unhealthy relationship with food, where it's just like, I started counting calories. And mind you, I had no knowledge of nutrition. I had no idea what I was doing. It was literally a matter of, like, it felt vindicating. For example, when I was just reading Kara Goucher's book, which is a great book. It's a great read. And I enjoyed, like, kind of the expose that she had of the Nike Oregon Project, which is a team and a program that I was infatuated with when I was growing up, but you can also see, like, that system had its own problems. And she talked of her own struggles with eating, and it was hilarious because it's almost like she took a moment out of my own life when she was saying, like, I stopped drinking any sugary beverages. Like, I didn't want to drink juice. I only drank water. And I remember having that thought process for thinking, like, that's how I'm going to lose weight, based on no science, mind you. Like, there is no logic behind it other than the fact it's like, oh, sugar equals bad. Food equals, you know, carbs equals fat equals weight gain equals slow. Like, it's just this really nonsensical, illogical mentality that you can get into, because it's just, you're basing all of your own body image off of that of those you see having success. It was a struggle to get back on to, like, this relationship with food, where I had to remind myself, like, you need to eat in order to be successful. And in running, it's just, you know, you don't do the kind of volume you do in cycling. But what I realized when I entered cycling was it was a sport that I actually really liked, because even if you're doing just, like, a regular, you know, training ride, let's say it's just like 2 hours, that's still 2 hours of straight exercise. And I think what was very important is my coach and a lot of the people that I was surrounded by when I was coming up in the sport were always encouraging me to eat. Like, they were just saying, like, this is a great sport because you get to eat while you're actually doing it, and it's encouraged. And so obviously there wasn't the kind of, you know, nutritional revolution, as I think a lot of people are calling it, this carbohydrate revolution that we're seeing right now. None of that kind of literature or rhetoric was being used back, you know, 10 years ago. But I still think I was able to develop a much more healthy relationship with food, because it wasn't even like I was trying to, I was training so much and I was just, like, training to eat, but it's just like I wanted to train more, and I realized, like, wow, I've really got to fuel more if I want to feel any kind of good on the bike. And so that helped that helped change my relationship with food a lot. And then now I've taken time to like reach out and then putting resources of my own towards working with a nutritionist, specifically because like I just don't think a lot of people know that, you know, if you're doing any kind of basic training, like even if it's that, you know, 10 to 15 hours a week, that is a lot of exercise that you need to be accounting for in your caloric intake. And I just, the amount of food that I would be eating in years prior is just nothing compared to what I'm eating now, because you just have to eat more if you want to perform. And I've been seeing that pay dividends in my training recently, because there was always a period where I would have like a great 2 week period and I'd be nailing the training, and then there'd be like 2 or 3 days where I'm just annihilated and I cannot get in front of it. And I think it was just because I wasn't staying on top of the nutrition. And I know this is like stuff that everyone's heard all the time, but truly it's the kind of thing where like being on top of it, like your body needs to consume things all the time if you're putting any kind of consistent training in.
I think it's funny too when people get into the sport and, you know, we just train so many hours. It's like, oh man, I only train 14 hours this week. But then if we step back and if we're not a cyclist and have someone who's not a cyclist in the room and they're like, dude, 14 hours? Like, they're like, I went to
Yeah,
the gym for
exactly.
free and that was like my all-star week. We just forget. We have such a skewed view of
It's
what.
totally skewed. It is utterly skewed. Like, I mean, it's just the thing is, like, people, for a lot of, you know, my friends who are professional athletes and myself, and I devote myself to the sport as much as a professional as I can be, like, they're like, oh my God, you're riding so much. I'm like, well, yeah, like that's the gig, that's the job, like that's what I got to do. Obviously, if I was working a full-time job, like most people, I wouldn't be able to ride this much. But that's not to say, like, I know people who work full-time jobs and still get in 10 to 15 hours a week. That's insane. That's really impressive. So it's not like, not only are you actually actively working, and a lot of these people are raising a family and are going out and playing with their kids, they're also waking up at the crack of dawn to actually do a trainer session or something in the winter. Like, that's honestly more hardcore than I think I'm willing to put in.
Oh, it's
So.
so hardcore. My friend Dan, we used to go out on these winter rides in upstate New York. It was freezing cold. We'd go out for 5 hours. I would come home and just be blasted. And I would talk to him like, oh man, I walked in the door and my two kids jumped on me. We did it, did it. And I was like, oh my God, bro, you
That's
have
what I'm
double
saying.
training session all the time. Is yeah.
No,
Kudos to all the
I think
parents
you
and
bring up a great You bring up a great point, where I just think a lot of people, there's a constant keeping up with the Joneses attitude in cycling, and I totally succumb to that all the time. I mean, you look at you, with online training tools such as Strava, where effectively it's the social media of exercise. It's the same unfortunate nature as Instagram, where you're having that FOMO. You see a person put in like a 35-hour, 40-hour psycho week, and you're just like, well, why can't I be doing that? And it's just like, oh yeah, that's right. Like, maybe that's just not what I need right now. Maybe that's not what my coach prescribed right now. Or maybe that's literally not what, like, the amount of time I have in my day allows. And that's okay. Like, that's totally fine. Like, everyone's different. And I know people who have had so, like, heaps of success off of 10 to 15 hours of training
Oh.
a week. Like, I know tons of people. So you're right. Like, everyone just needs to remember, like, everyone's life is different and everyone has their own approach.
Yeah, I'll date myself. I think it was Clayton Burrows on AXA, like 2010, was getting his PhD, trained 5 hours a week, and still won NRC or won. Like, and people were like, "What the hell?" And I mean, granted, he had years of riding, but it's he's like, "Dude, this is all I got. I mean, I can ride an hour 5 times during the week. Like, I'm still gonna race. I'm still gonna show up." But the Strava
Exactly.
point, man. Cole Patton was on here, gravel racer, crushes lifetime Grand Prix, and he said I got to get off Strava because I look at what everybody else is doing and I start freaking out and just not healthy for me. And I think I'm so glad there was not Strava when I started this sport. I would have it just would confuse me. It's like, why is this person doing this and this person's doing this and I want to this cat one is doing this and da da da. It's just too much information, I think. But yeah, it's. So you mentioned a nutrition coach. Do you have a coach for training also, or do you do that on your own?
Yep. So I've been working with the same coach that I actually started with at UCLA. So he was the coach when I was a freshman at UCLA, and then he and his wife moved to Minnesota when she got a job at McAllister, but we just kept in touch. And I don't know, I'm a big fan of, like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Like, it's the
Yeah.
kind of thing, like, when you've developed your rapport. And it's funny, I was actually talking about this, I can't remember with who, but my coach Eric Samuele and I think he's now one of the longest, like, consistent contact, friendship relationships that I've had in my adult life, because it occurred to me, like, this year marks 10 years working with him. And, like, I mean, it's pretty insane when I think about that, because, like, I mean, the poor guy, like, he's effectively, like, he's a friend, he's a coach, and I'm sure as mo a lot of other coaches can relate to this, like, you're a therapist to some degree, because there are days when I'm just, going on a diatribe in my Training Peaks notes of, like, this sucked, like, I feel so bad, like, why do I, is this even worth training for? Like, I mean, the guy is, he's managed to, like, screw my head on right so many times, and I owe a lot to him. But I think that's largely just because I've developed that rapport with him over so many years. And I think, to his credit, he has been a really effective coach. And not only his very mellow approach to things, like, he's always just been like, yeah, whatever, like, maybe you just didn't feel good, whatever, like, just eat a little more or something like that, or we'll get back to it.
It's too
And
easy as the athlete to get caught in the micro. And I think that's
oh my
like, he
God, it's
sounds like
so
the coach
easy.
that sees the macro, see the big picture. Because when you're there
Yeah.
doing all the workouts, it's like, what happened today? He's like, dude,
Yep.
you had a bad day. Onwards.
And I would like to think it's been interesting for him, because I feel like in the past 10 years that we've worked together, literally every year has been different to some degree, where there actually hasn't been, like, a time when I would think probably the, like, most consistent, it has been the last 3 years, when there was kind of more of a set schedule. But even then, like, the way the schedule pans out, the way my training pans out, I've always done something new or different, like, be it in the off season or in the actual, like, season itself, where, there's, like, a different structure of the racing, such that, like, I've been able to play around with how we train and what we do. And I think, I don't know, I'd like to think that it's been as interesting for him as it has been for me. Like, for example, this off season has probably been the most concerted off season training I've had possibly ever, or at least in the last, like, 5 years. So and this upcoming season is going to be, like, the most involved season I've had, I think, ever, in terms of the caliber of races and the style of racing that we'll be dealing with. So it's just, like, it's all experimental, and I think it's all exciting to be doing that with the same person.
Is that why you feel it's been the most concerted because of the new program coming up and like just some fresh kit to put on, fresh teammates? It's like, okay, I really got to show up here. Or what made this like the biggest off season?
I think it's largely just dictated by the calendar. I don't think the motivation came necessarily from joining a new team. Obviously, you want to show up and put your best foot forward with the new team. But I'd like to think, like, as I told Eric Hill, our director, multiple times, like, if I were to describe myself in any way, shape, or form, in cyclists, you have terms like climber, GC rider, sprinter, ruler. Like, I'd wish that there was, like, I think that, I guess this is lumped together under breakaway specialist, but I really like to think of myself as nothing else but an opportunist. Like, if the chance to go for a result comes about, then I will put my best foot forward, and I will make sure that my training is such that I can take advantage of it. But for the most part, I actually think, like, my role has been to help other people, especially in the last 3 years on Legion, when I was able to hone that role and figure out how to be the most effective domestique that I can. Like, I genuinely get a lot of satisfaction from being able to do that. And if I can go for a result here and there, that's great. But the calendar itself, I think, has dictated the way that this off season has gone more than anything, just because, as I was saying earlier, the season is going to start earlier than it has for me, I think, ever. And so, whereas in years prior, where I'm mostly just kind of putting in massive amounts of volume and just kind of getting the aerobic base built over a long-term style, in terms of just, like, putting in big volume days and maybe an occasional, tempo day or something, just to rev the engine a little bit, so to speak, this past season, I would say in the last, say, 2 months, 2.5 months or something like that, I either have a rest day, which means I'm spinning for an hour or something like that. I'm riding long, which is like more than 5 hours, or I'm doing an interval of some kind, whether that was, a sub-threshold interval or threshold interval. Like, those are basically the only three kinds of rides I've been doing. There hasn't been any ride really that's been like, a 3 hours or a 2 hours zone two. Like, it's all been extremely like focused and concerted efforts, and I've actually really enjoyed that. Granted, it's the kind of thing like I think you could probably only get away with knowing that the season is going to start in January, and you're not going to, like, a lot of the next couple of months, the fitness is going to be dictated by the racing, and so you're going to be able to accrue fitness by in the racing, which I haven't been able to do in the last couple of years, just because, for one, the calendar that we've been having didn't start in the domestic scene until April. So there wasn't a lot of racing that I could have done prior to that. There was some local racing, but most of that is just crit racing. And then two, it's the kind of thing where the racing wasn't like consistent stage racing or consistent hard 1 day racing where you would amass massive amounts of fitness. In most cases, when we would be doing these crit calendars, I would be doing like a lot of training even during like the race weekend or during the race block per se, because it's like you do a crit on a Saturday of 1 weekend, and then you'd have, the 6 days leading up to the next crit, and you still need to train because that crit was only 1 hour and 15 minutes. And I think in crits, you don't necessarily accrue fitness. Even if you're doing like a Tour of America's Dairylands or an Intelligentsia Cup, like, if your goal is to accrue fitness, you can't really do that with crit racing. You can have fitness going into it, and you can accrue like a top end racing fitness, but it's not like you can, build a base. And it's like, in some cases, it didn't matter for me to do that because the calendar was 99% crits. So that was just the kind of fitness I was looking at. And I think most of the time you can, like, the way you get better at racing crits is you race more crits, I think.
So I think a good thing to pull from that for people to hear is, if I hear you correctly, you believe that a big base no doubt helps you with crit racing, even though the race might be 60 to 120 minutes.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in my role, as someone where I was generally, within the first couple of guys in the lead out, the way that Legion had developed its style of racing, we would be taking the front. As the seasons went on, between 2021 and 2023, we would take the front with less and less time to go, but generally that still meant, with 20 minutes to go. And so at the very latest, I think, is when we would try to assume the front. And at that point, you're still trying to do like, you're putting out maybe like 80 to 90% wattage as you're riding the front. And so the idea is like, I think with crit fitness, you can get away with having a smaller base because the racing duration is just smaller, unless you're doing something, say, like a Clarendon Cup or a Bucks County, where you're racing for, 2 hours, and then the like longer, bigger base fitness starts to play into those effects. But in those shorter crits, I think it matters less. But I still think, like, in so few instances in cycling, in my experience, is it such that having a bigger base is a detriment? Like, I think having a big aerobic base can only really benefit you. And I don't know. In my opinion, that's just how I like training. Like, I just like riding a lot. And for some people, maybe they either just they don't have the time, and or they don't want to ride, as that many hours because of either other obligations or just their own personal preference. I think that's fine. And in crit racing, there are ways that you can structure training that can be very focused and very tailored to that duration and style. But for my role in the sport as like an early man in the lead out, where I would be riding the front or welding moves back together, a lot of what I was doing was just around like threshold or sub-threshold efforts. The bigger base, I think, played a large part in my ability to do the job, and that's how I trained.
Makes sense. I like that you call yourself an opportunist, because that was gonna be one of my questions. I think people that might know you from more the Instagram day of the past few years, like, oh, this guy's a crit guy. But if you look at wildlife, you're winning at Poyong Lake, you're I actually think I was at a time amateur Nats time trial when you were on Mark Pro. Do you top five, top ten there maybe? Because I remember seeing you. I didn't know the West Coast guys, and I think you crushed that. Dan was like, "Who the hell is this dude?"
I got second at the 20 when I did it. When I did amateur Nats in 2018, I got second. At the TT.
But then you're also doing like Turi, Utah. I mean, you kind of open up a huge training thing here, but do you see any similarities to did the training change at all? As you kind of discussed, there's like a lot of different things going on over these past 10 years with your coach. Wildlife, It seems more like you're truly, I mean, road race, breakaway guy, opportunist, you're time trialing. Mm-hmm. Then you're seeing, hey, I'm joining Legion. You'd reach out to them. Okay, this is more crit focused. Now you're going to Echelon, more stage races, probably a lot more racing. Do you think this will look more like the Wildlife days? Or is it still, as you said, I'm doing a big base. I'm getting ready for the races that are coming up. Then because I'm doing more stage races, I'll get a ton of fitness from that. Or is there any, it's kind of always a moving target, but I'm just curious, how do you see that over the past 10 years?
I think with Wildlife, with regards to the training there, relative to what I think this year is going to be, I think it will be fairly similar just because, again, the style of racing is going to be more similar in terms of what the calendar will be comprised of, i.e. longer form stage races, like hard stage races, because, again, like, American stage racing is interesting because the general structure of it, and this goes for Redlands, Gila, and Joe Martin, is you have your five-day format, Wednesday through Sunday, and typically in those 5 days, you have a time trial and a crit. So in terms of volume, the actual amount of volume in that five-day period isn't crazy high. Like, for example, in Redlands, generally you have the TT and the crit, so that, you know, together that only accounts for maybe like an hour and a half of racing total, maybe a little more, I think, maybe an hour 45. And then also you have, you know, a 2.5 hour day for Highlands. So again, it's not like you're dealing with like multiple back-to-back, you know, 100+ mile days on each of those days. It's like there are days when a lot of people can actually treat, you know, some people who are just going for stage wins, I've heard people say I treat the crit or the TT is like a rest day, basically. Like, I do what I need to do to make time cut, but the other days when it's mostly just about, like, road race fitness, those are the ones that I'm targeting. Same with Gila. You have a TT and you have a crit. And then Joe Martin, you have a TT and a crit. And the TT is, you know, if you're mailing it in, it's like a 10-minute effort or something like that. And it's the same thing. So it's like you're not getting massive amounts of back-to-back, like day on day, like day in and day out, like fitness. And that, like, as far as the road racing exposure that I've had in the past couple of years, that's been the bulk of it, is the North American block of like Redlands and Joe Martin. And then you have Nationals and then Maryland in the last 2 years that we did it. Versus in 2019, when I was on Wildlife, we would have big stage raid blocks in the North American scene, but then we would also be doing stuff like a Utah, and then I also had the privilege of doing Tour of California that year, and that was, it was hilarious because I arrived at that race with the most amount of fitness I had had up to that point since I had started racing, and then it was just, I go to the race and I just get my doors blown off because it's the hardest thing I've ever done. Because what it ended up being is, it's just like, it was 7 straight days, four consecutive ones of which were over 6 hours of racing on each day. So it was bananas. And people can look back at the Strava files I've had, and I'm pretty sure in each of the recaps that I write, it's literally like we go through stage one was, you know, a 3 hour day in Sacramento where we do a flat circuit. And I survived that one and I was kind of just in the pack and I'm thinking, okay, wow, hey, this world tour stuff is doable. Like, this is totally. And then we get to stage two. And I think stage two, we started in Stockton and then we raced up to South Lake Tahoe. And if you look at the profile of the day, effectively the entire day, all 220K of it was a steady uphill climb. It was just this gradual uphill climb, and my finishing time for the day, I think, was like 6:45. It was a 6 hour and 45 minute stage on stage two. And I remember finishing that and thinking, oh my God, that's the hardest thing I've ever done on my bike. Surely it can't get harder. Lo and behold, next day it was another like 6+ hour day where, we'd driven down from South Lake Tahoe. I can't remember if we where we went to after that. I think we did this section of PCH through Big Sur. Anyway, like each successive day after that became harder and harder, not least of which because I was steadily accruing massive amounts of volume and mileage in racing, which is a different kind of stress. But it was also just because you're learning how to race in conditions that you just don't really race in the North American scene. It's like most of the racing in North America is circuit-based racing, so you don't get a lot of exposure necessarily, for example, to crosswinds. So I remember on the stage when we did from into Ventura, I can't remember where we started. That day was probably the most brutal, not because necessarily of like the actual profile of the climb, but because that day was like a cross tailwind. And so for literally the entire day, the way that the hierarchy of the peloton was structured, it's like you'd have your sprint teams who are keeping the brake in check, then you have your GC World Tour teams, then you have your Pro Conti teams in descending order of prestige in terms of who's like the biggest names in those. And then, funny enough, ironically, at their home race, the national team, which I was a part of, we were dead last in the train. So literally we're yo-yoing as the group is accelerating and decelerating, accelerating and decelerating, up to the point where eventually Travis McCabe told us, he's like, Sam, guys, just we're all going to get in the line and we're just going to TTT back here. It doesn't matter how far ahead the wheel in front of you gets, just keep a steady pace. And sure enough, like we start doing that, and you can see the wheel in front of us, who is a member of a different team, would just go up and down and up and down, and we would just be keeping a steady pace because that was the only way that we were going to survive, because otherwise we were just eating wind all day. And
My
I was
God.
absolutely shelled. So the long and short of that was a long tangent to get to, but the point
That's all
is
right.
I think what I'm trying to get at is like the racing styles in the last 3 years with the crits have been completely different, but I don't actually think the training is going to be different. I think what is going to be different is the amount of fitness, or whether, I guess it's a question, I guess, whether or not I will be able to accrue fitness through racing such that I haven't been able to in the past couple of years, simply because like the style of racing that we're going to be doing is going to be that kind of consecutive volume racing, which I haven't had a lot of exposure to. It was really just that 1 year in 2019 when we had those consecutive stage races, in China or the domestic scene or over in Japan or going into the next year, Malaysia, like building on a season. I haven't had that kind of accumulation of long form fitness such that I can speak much to it, but everybody that I have heard talk about it says that that's like one of the biggest things that allows people to take that next big step in their like abilities is accruing that kind of fitness.
That's awesome. So, what do you, as you accrue this fitness, is there anything that you, and I think you said Eric was the name of your coach, that you guys are hoping to improve on to help you get to that next level? Anything that you've picked out that you want to share?
I mean, I think we haven't had any specific chats about that. I think largely what we've just been focused on in this part is, and I hate using this term because it's just like it's one that's been so like used up and trite at this point, but it's like we're gonna build the engine, like we're building the engine,
Build the
but
foundation,
that's,
Sam. Build the
yeah, it's
pyramid.
foundation
You're
period. Like I
building.
think, yeah, it's I like the analogy because I like motorsport, so I like to think of myself as like a machine in some cases. But I think the thing that I want to be able to see out of myself, if I were to say a goal right now, is trying to find a way to achieve that like gold standard of racing fitness that you hear all these pros talk about, where it's not necessarily about your raw wattage. You see a lot of people who can put out these mad dog watts in like a 20-minute test or something like that. If they just go out, tootle around and then hit the climb and then do the 20-minute test. I mean, there are actually a lot of people who can put out quote unquote world tour watts. Like they can achieve those numbers. But the differentiation is how well can you produce wattage under fatigue? And I think that's been what I've been trying to deal with, or what I've been trying to train is like I would be doing threshold efforts in the midst of say like a 4-hour ride or a 5-hour ride or something like that. And I try and like, and recently I've been trying to spread the efforts out. Let's say it's like a 4 by 15 minute workout at threshold where I would try and do, the 15-minute efforts over the course of the entire ride instead of simply trying to do like all four of them at the beginning and then just like be smoked for the end of it and just kind of mail it in as I'm like pedaling. The idea being is you want to, you can put out raw wattage, but it really doesn't make a lot of difference in terms of your overall performance as you try and achieve results, which at the end of the day, that's kind of what that's what you're racing a bike for. It means more to be able to do like put out say like 10 watts less than you could if you were completely fresh at the end of a 5-hour ride, if that makes sense. There's
Total.
a great podcast I was listening to. I don't know if you've ever listened to the Performance Process podcast from the Escape Collective with Ronan McLaughlin.
No.
Basically, it's a podcast that he was chatting with this coach Jacob Tipper, who coaches Ben Healy. And his whole shtick was basically talking about how the key to like trying to be able to race effectively is utilization of power at the right time, and most of that is just being able to, it's like your repeatability and your ability to produce power under fatigue. And so I think that would be one of my big like fitness goals for this year is like I know that I have like wattage that if I can train it well, can be utilized to either support my team in their own endeavors or like be opportunistic like I want to. But it's a matter of like, can I
Oh,
do that after 4 hours of racing?
totally. No, I love that. I think I've even tied them to like KJ. So I'll be like, okay, at 1,000, I'm gonna do a 10 minute. Then at 2,000, I'm gonna do another 10 minute. Because then, if I was doing them on the hour, I would catch myself loafing just at hour 3.5 and like easy, like saving up. I'm like, dude, this is not a rate. You're not going hard enough. You're like cheating yourself. So that's I like to hear that Sam Boardman's doing something similar. What's the when you were talking about? So it sounds like your favorite ride or maybe workout is the long ride. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you had mentioned some like threshold intervals, or what kind of intervals do you, maybe it's not your favorite, like, ooh, I love doing these, but you just find really effective that you might even actually hate doing, but you're like, these make me fast.
Well, I think it's funny. The efforts that I love doing, I also think are the ones that do make me like fat. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you differentiate between this. I feel like more and more I'm trying to differentiate between this because I do think there's a difference between fast and strong in cycling. And because I think like I think the ones that I really like is like a 4 by 15 minute or like a 3 by 20 minute or something like in that 15 to 20 minute range of like threshold effort, because it's the kind where if, for example, like my favorite kind of ride sometimes is when you just like you get into a rhythm on the climbs and you can like span the efforts over the course of an entire ride and you can make it feel like it's a race. I don't know, like when I lived in LA and I was training in the Santa Monica Mountains, the way that I would do it is I typically if I was given a prescribed amount of like time I needed to be in zone or something like that over the course of say like a couple 15-minute or 20-minute intervals, I would just map a ride such that it would be around the amount of recovery time my coach was wanting, such that I'd hit the climb right when I would need to be starting the effort, do the climb at the prescribed wattage, and then recover on the downhill, and then do the same thing on the next climb. And so the idea was, it's like it almost felt like you train your body and your mind at the same time to just like be ready to go hard on a climb, because that's just, I mean, that's how it's raced. Like that's usually the deciding thing, but. Like, I think I like those workouts a lot because, mentally, there's something about, for example, like 15 minutes, I think is that sweet spot where it's like just amount of time where it's easy for your brain to like break it up into like, okay, it's only like 3:15 five. I don't know. Like I
Yeah.
remember hearing a
Chunk
friend of
it.
mine. Yeah, exactly. You chunk it. I remember a friend of mine was talking like mentally. I think the human brain or something. And this could be completely apocryphal. I don't know if it's actually scientifically based, but he's like mentally the human brain processes things in threes the best. So if you can break something into three chunks, then it's like you can process it. So it's like 15 minutes. It's 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes. Easy. Like it's totally simple to break that down. Like once you get anything longer than say 20 minutes, I think the brain, at least my own personal brain, is just like, oh my God, it's over 20 minutes. Like that's a long time or something like that. And then it's like anything. I think my least favorite workout ever is like a 6 by 4 minute VO2 when you're doing it like 4 minutes at like 115% or something like that. That sucks. There's something about 4 minutes. It just like I can't. My brain just doesn't wrap around. And there was actually a period a couple years ago where I told my coach, I was like, I just don't think mentally I can comprehend this. Like my brain is just not wrapping its head around. Like I can't. Like it would be the kind of thing where I was becoming such like a head case with this kind of stuff where I was just like, I think we just need to find a different way to like shape the numbers so that my brain can comprehend it. So my coach, like to his credit, he's just like, okay, how about like I don't know, like 8 by 3 minutes, and I'm like,
Yes,
perfect. That's totally fine.
dude,
Like I can totally
this is
I can
hilarious.
totally do that.
I don't know who I was talking to, and I had said I can do 8 by 3 because it's that like really hard, and it's d 3 minutes. It's like death,
Yeah,
but okay,
exactly.
it's
Three
only 3 minutes.
minutes.
5 by 5 is what I came up on, so I'm like, it's 5 by 5. I just got to go in. But 6 by 4, I'm like, wait, I'm going to that hellhole, but it's only 4 minutes. But now I have to do it another time. Like, let me just go 5 minutes. And let me go, and four just seems weird. It's terrible. And
That's what
I'm
I'm
like,
saying. Like, I don't know.
normal.
That's
It's the
my
same
point.
amount of
Like,
time. They're like, you just said you like eight
and
by
that's my
three. Let me.
point. Like it speaks so highly that someone else was having this kind of like
Dude.
neuroticism in terms of like the interval work, but that's exactly my point. There's something like when you get down into like the nitty-gritty of it, like the difference between 3 and 4 minutes in my case was literally the difference of like me being able to do the workout and me being like not able to finish.
I think you're really smart though to do that on the climbs. I always reference James Piccoli, who was on here, who was talking. And again, I don't know if this was actual science, but that we are able to go harder when we're chasing a object in space. So like, I have to get to the top of this climb, as opposed to saying I have this 15-minute interval or this 21-minute or whatever. And so I think that's good for people to hear because it's easy to get caught up in it. So much is like numbers based, Strava and things on the internet. And hey, this is the workout that's going to get you on the podium. And it's like, well, I have this amazing climb, but it's only 13 minutes instead of 15 minutes. Like, dude, you're good. Go do that and then go do a 16 minute one. And then like be malleable. And so I love that. I think it's trying to do the workout on the terrain as it laid out is so much more fun too. Like that's going to lead to you enjoying the ride and the training, and it's this big picture, not just what are the watts today, go in my little nerd zone and like hate the ride. I don't know. So I
Well,
love to hear
absolutely.
that.
Exactly. No, I totally agree, especially with that, chasing a place in space versus an actual like wattage or time. And what I'll do a lot of times, for example, if I'm traveling or if I'm in a place, and I only have like access to a single climb, for example, or something like that, or say I'm just like doing an interval session, and the only way that I can do it, if for example it's like an 8 by 3 minute session. And it's not like I can map. I mean, if there was a route that I could do that's a loop where I could literally have like 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off, and it perfectly aligned with hills, I'd do it, but it just doesn't exist. What I will do is I will take careful note, like after that first interval that I do, of like where it is that I start on the climb and where it is that I finish on the climb, such that, okay, I know exactly the point in space that I'm going to finish if I just do the prescribed wattage, so I'm not going to look at my computer anymore. So I know that if I start here, I hit the lap, I'm not going to look at my computer for the rest of this interval. I'm just going to go to the place where I know that I'm going to finish the interval at, where if I was doing the correct wattage, it'd be done, and then I'll hit the lap. And that'll be it. And so that was a way that mentally I was able to get over that kind of hurdle instead of just kind of clock watching and you're just like counting down each single second. Instead, like you can kind of, I don't know, you just can kind of be in your own like fantasy world where it's just like part of, I think, what's cool about cycling is the fact that like you can feel racy every single day when you go for a ride. Like you wear the kit that you race in, you wear the shoes that you race in, you're riding the bike that you race in. Like you can feel like you're racing every single day. And so that's what I like to do. I basically just play pretend where it's like I'm on a climb. I'm pretending like I'm following a move. I know I must look like a psycho because in some cases, like I've actually done the thing where it's like I look back at this person that doesn't exist who's attacking me, and I'll pretend to like follow them. So I'll give like a little acceleration. But it really does help me when I'm in training because I'm a big fan of like visualization and like recreation of races. So for example, if you know, in the past couple of years in Nationals in Knoxville, there's Sherrod Hill, which is like a 2.5 minute climb. And I would go out and I'd try and find a 2.5 minute climb that had the generally the same characteristics as Sherrod Hill. And you train that, like, and you visualize that. Okay, this is probably how it's going to be raced at the bottom of the hill. They're probably going to go hard, settle in a little bit. There's a little bit of a flat section that you can kind of kick, but then there's that final little kicker up to the roller before the little left-hand bend, and then it's the dip. So it's like you visualize all of that, and I'm a huge proponent of that because I think it just like as you've been alluding to, and as I think both of us have been alluding to, like cycling is just it's so much of it is mental, especially now in all of this like the aero gains, the wattage gains, when you're talking about these marginal gains, like if you show up to the line and you're ready because you can visualize something, you can visualize a climb, then you're already ahead of the game.
I love that, man. You better be careful talking about not being down with aero gains, though, joining Echelon. Those guys
No,
love the aero
well,
gains.
that's the thing is I am down with it and I'm very excited. I mean, I don't know if I have to be annoyed or I have to be grateful, but even like my teammate Caleb, we're chatting about, you know, like we're talking tires and whatnot. And he's like, well, according to bicycle rolling resistance, you know, this tire is faster than this tire. And I'm like, what's bicycle rolling resistance? And he's like, oh, and then he sent it to me and I've lost hours of my life, like poring over comparisons of different tires. I'm like, well, this one has like this category of edge grip in the wet, but this one is a little more like durable with the punctures. And so it's just like, I'm all about it. I think like as annoying as it can be, I think like again, I love the tech side of it, and I think like it that is part of the part of the sport that I think is cool and what I do love about it because it's the kind of thing where going back to your original question, or one of your original questions of like body image, for example, I think cycling accommodates a variety of different body types, body structures, and you know, different kinds of people who can all see different kinds of success. And you've seen people play to their own body types or play to their own interests or their own capabilities a ton in years past, like Alex Dowsett, Victor Campenaerts. Like you have these guys, like even Victor Campenaerts went out and just went ahead and said stuff like, I can't be a TT specialist anymore because the like raw wattage that these people can do on top of like the actual like aerodynamic like testing that they're doing, I can't beat that. So I'm going to take all of my aero knowledge and apply it to the road racing and just be a breakaway specialist. And he saw success when he made that switch. I think, you know, between 2019 and 2020, I think he won a stage in the Giro out of a breakaway that he, you know, after he had specifically made that comment in the interview where he's like, I'm not a TT specialist anymore. And the same with like Alex Dowsett, who I read his book recently, and he was always very clear when he said like I was never the strongest guy in the group, but I always made a point to like be the one doing the little things with the aero testing, like or you know finding the most aero shoes, like making sure my position was dialed or something like that, such that you know when it came time for me to get a result, I was able to get the result because I had done the homework. So I definitely think like I am not a Luddite when it comes to that kind of stuff. Do I wish that it could just be like how hard can you pedal the bike? I do because I think the unfortunate nature is like with trying to find speed comes a price tag, and a lot of people don't have the means or the resources to do that. But I do think like the reality is like it is a bit of an arms race right now.
That, but then also, I think for the amateur cyclists, which most people listening to this are going to be not at your level, it's way more of like understand positioning, understand the tactics, understand when to use the match, understand how to put the effort in at the end of your 2-hour road race. And so I think people get so caught up now in like, I don't have the most aero wheels and I don't have these watts that this person has on Strava. You know what? I'm not going to go to the race. I'm like, that's the dumbest thing ever.
Yep.
Because that person might come in 24th because they just suck ass at racing. Excuse my friend. But like, it just holds people back sometimes. And I'm like, just go race. Like, go learn.
No, I think that's a really good point to make. And I think what I would stress too is I've known cyclists who have themselves self-proclaimed, you know, I will never say that I'm the strongest rider in the field, and they've said like my wattage relatively speaking is very low, I'm not like strong. But I honestly think those riders who don't have like raw power to amend mistakes that they make in the race are the smartest bike racers you will ever see, because they are the most economical and efficient in how they navigate the peloton. So if there's anything that you can learn as an amateur, I think, from, you know, perhaps combating like the aero arms race that is, you know, currently happening in the peloton, is like you learn how to be efficient. Because I'm sure like mentally there is something to be said for someone who arrives like to a start line thinking like, I have the most aero bike in the world. Maybe I can just sit on the front that little bit longer because, you know, I can do that because I've got the pulley wheels. I've got like, you know, my position's dialed. Like, and maybe that is the case. Maybe it isn't. But the point is, it's like you said, learning how to race and learning how to navigate the pack and learning when to go, when not to go is as much a part of racing as the actual tech side. Arguably, it's more important because, you know, you need to be able to navigate a pack to be able to utilize aero gains in the first place if you're going to try to win. Yeah. So if you can't do that, it doesn't make any difference.
I love that. Dude, I want to be respectful of your time. Can we do five?
No, I've got all the time in the world. So you
okay?
Ask away.
I got five more that I'm real curious about. And these can be short if you want them to be. In the gym, yes or no? Worth it or not worth it?
It's worth it. It's definitely worth it. Am I in the gym? Not as much as I should be. I think it matters more as you get older. And it's again, I'm sure there are people who are listening to me and being like this. I mean, I'm 28 and there are probably people who would be like, this freaking ankle biter doesn't know what old means. But it's like, I don't know. I think as you get older, there's a lot of literature that I've read that has basically said like, you know, arbitrarily, if you were to pick a number, it's like around age 30 for men, at least. And I can't speak to the physiology of women, so I'm sure there's some literature there. I would hope, you know, science tends to favor like men as their subjects, which is unfortunate. But the literature that I've read for men is there's a lot of data that says like use it or lose it, in the sense of like in terms of like muscular recruitment and muscle mass. Like, you have to be getting in and doing supplementary gym work unless you want your, you know, muscle mass to start to fade. In terms of general cycling stuff, I do think there is a place for it. And I think if you work with like a strength coach or a cycling specific like gym coach there, or you can speak to a coach in the gym about like what exercises you want to do, it's not necessarily about, I think, performance gains, that building, for example, muscle mass in the gym. I think it's mostly, and a lot of people I would reckon would corroborate this, about injury prevention and trying to rectify imbalances. Because I think as I've come to learn this off season too, and I've like fiddled around with some stuff with my fit, like you don't notice it when you're younger, but like injuries and imbalances and consequential imbalances start to stack up over the years, which can then create like muscle imbalances in your body. And so I think gym work can be used to readily like repair some of that and create more of like a symmetrical, even keeled position on the bike, which leads to more power and to better comfort. So if you can go to the gym, I would say that'd be great. I'm not saying like if you're a road cyclist you need to be doing like max deadlifts like every day, but I think there's a place for it. Yeah.
So since it's not the gym, what's the number one thing that makes you fast?
I think there's this great old, I don't know, like proverb, I guess you could say, in cycling that a friend of mine told me, and my coach consistently tells me, is there's no such thing as overtraining, just underresting.
Yes.
Again, I don't like subscribing to platitudes, but I think that one's a really good one because I truly think, like, you can train yourself into oblivion. Like, that's, I mean, you have people who are doing these crazy, like, 35, 40-hour weeks or whatever, like, they're doing a ton, but in general, the athletes that you see doing that and seeing success, I guarantee you, like, they dial in their time very effectively so that they're on off their feet, or they're doing the little things to recover. They're making sure that they're eating properly. They're making sure that they're getting enough sleep. They're not scrolling forever into infinity on their phones before they go to bed, and just like getting just stimulated on lights and color. Like, they're actually like trying to take time to relax and make sure that their body can soak in that fitness, because it's one thing to do the training, but it's another thing for your body to actually be able to adapt. And if you're not giving your body adequate rest to be able to do that, it's just constantly going to be inflamed, and you're never going to be able to actually like accrue fitness. You're just going to be able to accrue fatigue.
I love that. What's speaking of fatigue, and this isn't to like poop on any training methods or things, whatever, is have you ever done anything that you look back in training and like, that didn't work for me, or like maybe I should have tried something different? And it might have just been something that you and Eric like, hey, let's try this out, and it's just like, no, not for me. Besides the 6x4.
Well, I think the thing is, it's like, again, there it's never really been trying different things. There have been a couple different things that we've tried in training, but it's kind of just been like little tweaks here and there. Again, it's hard to say because every season that I've been racing a bike has been pretty different to some degree or another. So it's not like I can look at two seasons that are identical to one another and see if I made gains or if I didn't based on like training or not. And I actually like that. I don't know if it's just my own training ADD, but like I like the consistency that I have in training versus the diversity that I have in racing. I like how it's that is the way that it goes and not the other way around, because I think that allows me to just apply the training in different areas. And I actually, because again, like the whole point of racing a bike is you're trying to get results, whether for yourself or for your team. And so it's like, to me, I see it more as like I've taken fitness that I know I can confidently accumulate based on the training that I've done fairly consistently over the couple of years, but it's just a matter of like how do we then utilize that training specifically into this new calendar. So I think the one thing that I can distinctly remember, if I were to pinpoint a single event, was that left me like completely obliterated, was in 2017. It was a summer where I was pretty determined to race as much as I could. It was the first year that I was on what was then known as Herbalife 24 PB Mark Pro Nature's Bakery. Wonderful, wonderful amateur program run by the great Philip Mooney up in NorCal. But the idea for me was, I'd finished school and I had talked to my coach and I had talked to Phil, and he was like, well, these are all racing opportunities that you can take advantage of should you want it. And I was just like, I'm gonna race as much as I physically can. And I told Eric, and we both decided, like, you're just basically gonna bite off as much as you think you can chew, and we'll just see what happens after that. So I think in that period between middle of June to the, call it, end of July, I raced North Star Grand Prix back when it was like a 5-day, 6-stage race, and that's a
R.I.P.
great race. May it rest in peace. That was, I think, one of the best stage races in America. I raced North Star. From North Star, I went to U23 Nats in Kentucky. I then did Tour of Americas, or maybe I went from North Star to Dairylands, Dairylands to U23 Nats in Kentucky. From U23 Nats, I went back to California. I did a local crit there, and then we drove up to do all of BC Super Week, and then we drove back down to do Cascade. So it was something like in the course of, I think it was something in like 60 days, I raced like 40 of them or something like that, maybe even more.
Crazy, dude.
Needless to say, I arrived to Cascade like feeling kind of tired, and by the time we got to Aubrey Buttes, I was a shell of a human. Like I
Oh
was
my
just
God.
completely drained, completely annihilated because I just like I'd been racing virtually nonstop, and this was again before I had any notion of what proper nutrition in race and out of race or recovery was. And so it was mainly just me like I'm gonna go, and even like racing tactics, I'm just gonna go and race these like an idiot. I'm gonna try and like maybe I can go force a break. Maybe I'll just race hard. And so I'm just racing hard every single day without any like real tactical nuance or nutritional support to back up like the F like as the old phrase goes, my body was trying or like my mind was cashing checks that my body couldn't cash, like
There
or
you
was
go.
writing checks my body couldn't cash or something like that. So I arrived to the end of that period just annihilated, like barely even wanting to look at a bike. And I took like a solid week of like just like crew. I was the person that I was dating at the time. I stayed with her and Marin, and I was just like tooling around Marin, just kind of soft pedaling on bikes. And then I got back to LA and I was working a gig at a bike shop, and I decided like, okay, I'm now feeling up to par to like put in a good effort of training after all this racing. I put in a month of what at that point, and honestly to this day, was still probably some of the best like training that I've ever done. And I went to a trip in China later that year, and at the time that the results that I got in China were the best that I'd ever gotten. So it was kind of like the initial period of that giant race block was probably overzealous, but I know that like after that, it was the kind of thing that confirmed to me and my coach that my body and the way that my physiology works is I react very positively to volume. Maybe it's a little further down the line, but volume is like how I can accrue fitness really effectively. And so I did that race block, died, was reborn, did a training block, and then went back to China and had the best race of my life up to that point. So it was like, it was, yeah, it definitely, it was kind of a baptism by fire, but it's something that ended up working in like a very retrospective way. I don't necessarily recommend that for.
I was wondering if you were feeling like you were flying maybe after that tour of California beat down, because it's like just the mega volume recover, and then you come back to something that's like nothing's going to be on that level, and you go to do some, pro-am racing, and it's like, oh, I was crushing. Do you remember that at all?
It's hard to, so I think it was hard to say because I ended up after California, I finished up and it was kind of funny because it's like you finish in Pasadena and I didn't make the circuits. And so I always just tell myself like I didn't actually finish California. Like I, they stopped us before we did the Rose Bowl circuits, and I remember Jess, my wife, who at that point she had raced, I think it was her fifth tour of California. She had just finished her race. She was waiting for me in like the athlete parking lot or something, and I had gone to talk to the UCLA team, who had, it was so cool. They had ridden out to go watch the stage, and again, I'm just like completely cracked, and I'm trying to be there and be positive and be like, this was such a great experience. Whereas in my head, I'm like, oh my God, like. I'm nothing right now. I'm just totally cracked. I remember driving home from that. It was literally like we drove home from Pasadena back to where we were living at the time in San Diego. Like, and like it was a local race. We were just like, all right, guys, bye. Like, I'm just gonna ship on out, pack my bike in there. And I remember thinking like, I'm never gonna recover from this. And I thought I had started to like come around, and then I think within the next 10 days, I was sent to China, where we were going to China for a stage race, and unfortunately, I crashed out stage two, like messed up my knee like pretty badly, and so I then like I wasn't really able to see if I had accrued fitness in like the short term. But again, actually, to my earlier point, like I did California. I did those stage races. And again, the only similarity in seasons I can see is that of the 2017 and 2019, when in 2019, similar to 2017, I did a massive big block in like the first part of the season, and I think I accrued massive amounts of fitness. I did tour California and I did that stage race in China. I died. And then I went back into the summer and I did a really concerted period of training ahead of Utah. And I thought I had a really good Utah. And then I went back another concerted period of training and I went back to that state same stage race, Tour of Poyang Lake. And I had the best, like one of the best races to this day that I've had at that period. And I think it was, again, that accumulation of fitness that I was talking about earlier, where it's like, I know I'm seeing it. And it's actually, it's great that you're asking me because now it's actually forcing me to analyze this in real time. But I'm seeing like the accumulation of fitness, I don't think I would see, and I reckon not a lot of people would see in like any kind of an immediate time frame, but you see it in the long term build up. But you just got to remember to give yourself time to recover.
That's awesome. My last question. What are you eating on the bike? Whether it be long ride or let's do the two extremes, long ride and 60-minute crit. Well, no, because you're probably not eating anything. What are you eating on the bike? We'll leave it at that.
Well, I can answer that. So we can start short and work our way up. So 60-minute crit, I would, depending on like the time of day, generally, when we were working with SIS, with Legion, and then we were kind of like, we were able to buy our own nutrition, and then we had some scratch mix provided us, the team, but most of us were still using SIS product. I would be doing, a so I'd hit like my routine, especially in the summer races when it's super hot. SIS has this menthol gel that's meant
Yes.
for indoor training. Yeah, it's like 150 milligrams of caffeine in a gel. It tastes awful, but what's really cool about it is, again, that menthol actually I think helps cool you down. And so, for example, night one of Tulsa 2021, I took a hit a menthol gel, and I had like an ice bag in both armpits, on my chest, on my back, and this is one that probably not a lot of people would like, and I'm not sure if I even liked it, but I was just told like you got to hit the major arteries, and one of the major arteries are in your crotch, so yeah, I put one in my crotch too. So it's like, I think I had six ice bags on me. I hit the menthol gel, and at one point it's like 105 degrees in Tulsa, and you know, this late night in June, and I'm actually like shivering on the start line because I'm just like drenched in cold, icy water, and I just hit this menthol gel, and I'd be doing the like to try and get the like cool feeling.
That is
But then
amazing. I
in the
wish we had
race,
video of that.
oh dude, in the race, I would probably maybe I'd hit like a single 40-gram gel, but knowing now again, like what I know, I would recommend. For hard efforts, even for like as short as a crit, you probably want to be doing upwards of like 90 grams of carbohydrates an hour. So that would be the equivalent of like two SIS gels now. But now, Project Echelon, we're lucky enough to be working with First Endurance. So as we work our, you know, work our way up on what do I eat on the bike and longer rides. So now, again, depending on how deep into a training block I am, it kind of is. I go between, say, like 45 grams of carbs an hour if I'm like early in a block, to if I'm at the end of a 3-week training block or something, and my body is definitely like you're craving more fuel as you get further and deeper in the block. I'm ranging between like 70 to 90 grams of carbs an hour for zone two rides. And that comes in the form either of First Endurance's, they just came out with, a new high carbohydrate drink mix that I actually really like. So it's for the 2-scoop portion, it's 60 grams of carbs per bottle. And so, you know, I can go the first 2 hours of my ride just like sipping on that and be totally fine. And you can even like add more scoops of it, which I have to, you know, you can do 3 scoops and that'll be 90 grams. And I've done that for workouts and it works great because it's just like an easy way to take on gels or take on carbohydrates. They have, same with First Endurance, they have their energy shot gels, which is like 28 grams of carbs that are it's really easy to take on, so I like using those. And so generally I use the gels and the drink mix for tempo workouts, for example, when I'm trying to simulate racing and I'm doing like either sub-threshold or threshold efforts. So for those I'm generally aiming for about like 120 grams of carbs an hour. So I would maybe do like, you know, an entire bottle filled with 90 grams worth of First Endurance's drink mix and like one or two of their gels. Otherwise, if it's just a zone two ride and I'm aiming for between, say, like 45 and 70 grams of carbs an hour, I would try and do. I think the thing actually that I've really come to love is dried fruit, because it's like it's just like a different texture. I think there's something to just actually like chewing food that makes you feel like you're getting full. Rather, like you could theoretically do an entire training ride like zone two on gels, but I don't know. It's like at one point you just don't want to eat a gel, right? And so I actually think like I love, love, love Trader Joe's mango slices. Those are really good, and of course I get the ones with extra sugar, so those ones are really great. I also really like I mean, I'm a big Trader Joe's fan, largely because we don't have them in Montana, so whenever I'm in California, I just like binge whatever Trader
Stock
Joe's
up.
products, yeah, stock up on whatever I can get. Trader Joe's has their own like little Pop-Tarts. I really love those little Pop-Tarts for rides. Those are great. This will probably polarize a lot of people. Obviously, like I'm an American cyclist. The gas station stop, especially in California, is like pretty obligatory. I'm actually a huge proponent of like a complete palate cleanser at the gas station. So that could come in a, you know, more of a like a refined Doritos Cool Ranch type way, or as I prefer it, I'm actually like I really love like those disgusting like chicken salad sandwiches that you get at a gas station. Like for some reason, that's just my favorite thing in the world. I know I'm
Yeah,
playing Russian
good
roulette with that like one of these days, but that's truly one of my favorite things to eat because it's just like
one.
I don't know, it's just it's creamy, it's salty, it's just like everything that all the like gels and the sugary food that I typically eat for most of the workouts is not. And I think that's why I like it, is it's because it's a complete like on the other end of the flavor spectrum.
You'll get down with some of these bike packers I've worked with, but they'll send me pictures of like what they're like. This is an hour 36. I'm like, that. How are you riding a bike after that? They're like, 'cause I can't eat sugar. I'm like, that, wow, okay, interesting. And it's just
Yeah,
like
no,
greasy burger with
I.
fries. And I'm like, huh.
Yeah, most of
So.
the time, yeah.
All right, well, I like that. That's a good carbs and then maybe chicken salad sandwich on the longer rides.
Again,
We're
I can't really recommend most. In
gonna
fact, I would actually say I'd recommend against it because, like, for the most part, like, you really are like. You're putting your health on the line, you're gambling with it, but in my mind, it's just like it's worth it because it's just to me, it just tastes really good.
We'll put it in the bro science bucket of the other
Yeah.
comments you've made before. So,
Yeah.
man, this was awesome. We're gonna put links in for people to check out the last best ride. Your Instagram, obviously, Jess's Instagram. Do you do anything else on social media, or like blogging, or anything else people should follow you on? Maybe Strava or any other avenues that you're out there putting stuff out on?
Not right now. I might be doing some rider journals, but that's still in the works right now.
Cool.
If something changes, you said that this won't come out probably until like later in the
Until like
winter, so I
March, I
can.
want to say. Early
Yeah,
March.
okay. So I mean, maybe something will come about. If that does, I can easily just send you the information therein. The other thing I know that the team I participate in the podcast for the team, so that's the Sticky Bottle podcast that the team runs. I'm an occasional guest on that one. And then I'm trying to think of other things. Oh, I mean it's March. If
If you
it's
think of
March,
something, we
yeah,
can
it might
always
be
put it in
March.
later. So if something new pops up or you think of something, yeah, let me know. Any last words for the people?
Oh God. I mean, I feel like I've rambled
No,
on enough. I don't
this
know.
was awesome. Yeah.
I think a lot of people know that my mantra is just trying, like I love in racing, out of racing, trying to just help people find success or be happy in the sport. And I think that's, in my opinion, that's the best way that you can, you know, not only see find your own joy in the sport, but bring joy to others is like, I don't know, in whatever way, being a good teammate, even if it's just like a little thing, like make sure if you see someone they look like they're changing to flat, just ask them if they're okay. Like, ask, do you need anything? And if they give you the thumbs up, that's great. And if not, maybe you pull over and help them. Just like little things like that that keep the cycling community as great as it is. Like, I just think there are a lot of ways that people can help the community and help each other in uplifting and very simple ways. And I would encourage everybody to try and pursue that and become involved in your own local cycling community. Like, I think people don't realize how much they can do themselves to organize and galvanize their own like constituents for a good force. So I think that there's a lot that people can do. So if there's something that you're passionate about, go for it. Like you can build something.
I love that, man, because I think back to when I caught the cycling bug and when I was just obsessed with, like, gotta get my Cat One, gotta try and win this race, gotta get on this team, da da da. I know that I had the blinders on and I was taking from cycling and I probably wasn't really giving back as much as I should have. So that's a really good final. Kind of, it hits home for me for sure. I'll be definitely thinking about that.
And
Dude,
I'm
hey.
not here to say like, yeah.
No,
I'm
you're
not here.
here
I
to.
just one last thing. I just want to make sure, like, I'm not here to say like, 'cause I was the person with the blinders on, and I think like you can achieve your personal goals and that's great. I just think like you can also, in addition to that, you can get so much more out of the
Totally.
sport if you just, yeah, get involved. Anyway,
Totally.
sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you on that.
No. I think you made a good point. It just it definitely makes me think of, like, some. I guess I'll go deeper on that because I was talking to Doug Zell, who started Intelligentsia, about 3 or 4 years ago, and we were talking about Evoke Bike, and he was like, there's people in life that are takers, and I'm gonna butcher how he said this, but and he's like, there's people that are willing to give more. And as we were talking about this, he's telling me to look for people who are givers, who want, as we're trying to grow this business. And in my head, I'm like, as he's talking, I'm like, man, I think I'm actually more of a taker right now. Like, it made his, just his word hit me in a weird way. I was like, ooh, like, yuck. And so it's just always a good reminder from, like, someone like Doug, someone like you, like, yo, dude, give back, give out, reach. There's someone who had said, spend a third of your time aspiring to the people above you. Try and be Sam Boardman. Try and be this next great rider. Spend a third of your time with your peers and, like, go crush with everybody. And then don't forget, a third of your time reaching down to bring people up, because people definitely brought us up to some point. So it's like just those
No, I like
little.
that.
It is super cliche, and you would use I forget what word you used before, like placard or something, platitude, but
Like
like sometimes those,
a platitude. Again,
yeah,
I
sometimes.
apologize if I sound super pretentious when I bring that stuff up. That's the English
Not at
major
all,
in me
dude.
where I was like, I gotta use this degree for something, so I'm just gonna sprinkle a fancy word in here sometimes. So apologies to
I
everybody
think.
listening to me who are like, this guy's an utter tool. You're right.
No, dude, these little reminders, they're good. I mean, it's like sometimes the simplest thing just hits, and it can, a micro change can have a macro result. And yeah, so everybody follow Sam, check out the rides. Thank you guys so much for spending time with us and checking out. Thank you, Sam, so much. And we'll talk to you guys all soon. And